Globalization paved the way for multinational corporations to reap big profits. But it also opened the door to large-scale tax avoidance schemes. So how do you make sure governments get their fair share of tax revenue from those profits?
It's an effective rate of 15%. That's the minimum tax rate. So now zero taxation becomes, technically possible, but the multinational company then will pay the minimum tax somewhere else.
And as Shafiq says, in the lower competition environment, which the global minimum tax creates, there's an opportunity to revisit rates, tax incentives, think about their own domestic minimum top-up taxes. And so we also help through our capacity development work to bring people along. I'm Corey Hillier. I'm a senior counsel at the IMF working on tax law design and drafting issues, particularly on international tax issues.
My name is Shafiq Hibous. I'm an economist. I work on tax policy issues, and I've been working for the IMF for about 10 years.
So international taxation is a complicated affair, but efforts by global institutions like the OECD with its global tax deal and the UN's new tax convention are showing promise. The IMF is also applying its expertise in tax policy to help strengthen those efforts. Corey Hillier and Shafiq Hibous are part of that effort. So first, people disagree on a lot of things when it comes to taxes, but I think pretty much everyone, barring maybe some CEOs of these companies, would agree that corporations that make lots of profits generally don't pay enough taxes. So why is it so hard to get these companies that are very profitable to pay their fair share of taxes in the countries that they're working in?
Because the International Corporate Income Tax Framework was established in the early 20th century during the interwar period. And multinationals at the time operated very differently from multinational today. Mm-hmm. So at the time, a company would establish a foreign plant basically to reproduce what they produce at home. So the company will produce the same thing again from A to Z. The motivation is to produce close to markets where the consumers are.
Right.
So at the time, the international kind of corporate income tax framework, they had in mind this picture of machines and plants, and where the production is, where this plant is, we will tax. Mm-hmm. And we will treat the multinational headquarter and that foreign plant as completely separate entities.
Right.
This is very different from today's reality. First, the multinational companies, I like to call it the global firm nowadays, mm-hmm. it has a sophisticated global supply chain where each member of the group produces for the whole globe. It's not that you are producing to consumers just surrounding that location.
Right.
This means conceptually, it's difficult to say which location contributed how much of the value of that end final product. Mm-hmm. The second thing is digitalization. I can now serve a market without even being physically there. So Spotify and Google don't even need to be in that country.
Right.
So that leads to fundamental questions, which country should tax what? So we have a discussion of what they call taxing rights between countries. The third is basically the value is being increasingly generated by intangibles and services.
So from goods to services.
Exactly. It's not anymore this picture of heavy machine that is only producing or mainly producing the value. Now we have patents, we have marketing services, we have legal services, we have all sort of intangible values. These are issues and create challenges for taxation for two reasons. One, they are highly mobile. Mm-hmm. That means the intensity of competition between countries become more severe. It's more easy to tax compete, to attract these mobile activities. Mm-hmm. Second, they are difficult to price. Recall, we were just saying now, the current system says each company in the group would be treated as if they don't know each other, as if they are not related to each other. But if you have one member in the group that produces, say, marketing services for the whole group, how would you determine the cost or how much to attribute to each member in the group? it's difficult. There is maybe no easy world market price for that service. The implication is the group has some leeway now to price these internal transactions in a way to shift profits to lower tax jurisdictions.
Okay, so profit shifting is something that we hear a lot about these days. How does it work, Corey?
So it relates to what Shafiq was talking about, which is the design of the system is old. And so when we apply the system, we look at companies separately as single entities. So you imagine a multinational that has multiple operations in different countries. It can easily put transactions cross-border between two subsidiaries. And it can, to some extent, manipulate the price because it's calling all the shots. Yeah. And so if you want to profit shift, then what are we talking about? We're shifting the location of profits outside a high-tax jurisdiction to a low-tax jurisdiction. And we can do this in a multitude of ways. And as a lawyer, you know, without revealing all the toolbox, you could do it simply by just having an offshore parent provide a loan to a subsidiary at a high interest rate. Imagine the local subsidiary is paying high interest, which offsets the profits in the local jurisdiction, reduces the profit, and essentially through the interest payment shifts it out to the offshore parent, which might be in a low tax jurisdiction. That's a simple example. But of course, as Shafiq said, where multinationals become more sophisticated, you could have intellectual property in the offshore low tax jurisdiction that's charging a royalty to the local high tax jurisdiction, and so on and so forth. You can design many ways to shift profits out of a high tax jurisdiction to a low tax jurisdiction.
So what about international tax treaties? So most people are familiar with these, and they're generally set up to avoid people being double taxed when they're living and working in two different places. How does that work for multinational companies?
Yeah, so this is another excellent point, that tax treaties were established, you know, 100 years ago, when it was about relieving double taxation in the context of businesses that operated physically in jurisdictions.
Yeah.
And so those treaties have what we call allocation rules. So if you're doing a cross-border transaction, the treaty is going to tell you where the profit is taxable, either in the market jurisdiction or the offshore investor jurisdiction. And what these treaties do is they're based on old technology, essentially. And so what that technology says is a market jurisdiction where there's profits being generated from a local market can only tax those profits in that local jurisdiction, notwithstanding they're arising from the jurisdiction itself, if the non-resident seller business has a physical presence in the local jurisdiction. And you can imagine back in the day when offshore seller through local distributor sells to local consumers, we're picking up all the profits in the local jurisdiction because there's a physical presence. But now we have digitalized businesses, offshore sellers selling directly to consumers without a physical presence in the local jurisdiction where the consumer is, and the treaty norms don't allow taxation.
All right. So I mean, there's been this international effort to try and sort out this taxation problem, and what has come out of it, I think, within the past few years is this system that we call BEPS, B-E-P-S, which is the base erosion, profit shifting, tax avoidance rule system. Well, first of all, maybe give us a 101 on how that works and how effective that has been.
If you think about profit shifting and tax competition being the core concerns, where we have large residual profits being shifted into low tax jurisdictions and not being taxed at all, this is the fundamental issue. So BEPS, base erosion profit shifting, comes along with wave one. And wave one was really about the most egregious forms of tax avoidance. And it tried to somehow constrain those through law reform. Now, the system fundamentally stayed intact. So you could imagine the system that's already flawed, we've tinkered with it a little bit, but flaws remain. And so what we found was multinationals were still, through the current system, even though slightly tightened, able to shift profits to low tax jurisdictions. So BEPS wave two happens. And so we have things like global minimum taxes, discussion about more fundamental reform, about the way profits, taxing rights are allocated between jurisdictions. So I would say it's been somewhat effective, but we're in a period now where there's an implementation of a global minimum tax, which we think will have positive effect. But we're also in a moment in time where an aspect of the deal, which is the more fundamental reform, is uncertain in the sense that it's not clear whether the package is going to be agreed upon multilaterally by the group of countries that are negotiating that aspect of the deal.
Okay. So, Shafiq, there is BEPS and there is this new system, or at least you and Corey have been involved in publishing this paper about a system called the Global Anti-Base Erosion Tax Rule System. Maybe explain to us what this GLOBE system is. And I assume that this is being, or you're trying to introduce this as a means to address some of the shortcomings of the BEPS system. So maybe how does it do that? And also how it might help increase global corporate income tax revenues.
Yeah, of course, the world of global corporate income tax is full of lovely acronyms and fancy words.
You
probably noticed that GLOBE is one of them. BEPS is another. As Corey said, so basically the BEPS kind of package that was adapted in 2015 consists of 15 actions, they are called, between, you know, a range of minimum standards and best practices. All these actions are basically having kind of one purpose, and that is to make it more difficult to shift profits from one jurisdiction to the other.
Right.
But as Corey said, they maintain the system. It's still this old system. Companies within the multinational group ultimately are treated as if they are not related. But let's make it more difficult for them to transact in a way that is only meant to shift profits. A specific example would be you put a limit on the interest deduction by one affiliate. So that's going to the example that was given by Corey. So you can deduct your interest up to a specific cap, for example. Now that, even those rules, even if they were to function fully as we would like them to function, they do not address the issue of tax competition between countries.
Right.
A country can still lower its rate to attract whether profits or actually real investment. And in 2021, there was this agreement on a two-pillar kind of solution to address fundamental issues in this debate. Pillar two envisages basically a minimum tax, and that is the GLOBE rule, is basically a minimum tax.
But, I mean, what about the profit-shifting issue?
Yep.
I mean, if they can profit-shift, they can also avoid this minimum tax, no?
Yeah. So the minimum tax works as follows. It's an effective rate of 15%. That's the minimum tax rate. So for each multinational, I will look at each affiliated company in each country and look at their profit. Is it taxed at 15% or not? If it's taxed at 15%, the company's off the hook. If it's taxed, say, at 12%, mm-hmm. then there will be a top-up of 3 percentage points.
Ah.
So that's how it works. Now, that addresses profit shifting, going back to your question, mm-hmm. because to some extent, it does not eliminate it,
yeah.
but it lowers the incentive to shift profits. Because before the agreement, say, the tax differential between two countries can go between, say, 25% and zero.
Right.
Now, it will be between 25% and 15%.
Yeah.
So in that sense, there will be still scope to shift profits, you're absolutely right, but the incentive is less than before, if implemented, if the agreement is implemented. It does address also tax competition in the sense it puts a floor on the applicable tax rate. So now zero taxation becomes, I mean, technically possible,
mm-hmm.
but the multinational company then will pay the minimum tax somewhere else. If you as a country say, I will not tax you, come to me, and I'm not going to implement the agreement, you can do that. But the headquarter country, if it implements the agreement, it would tax at 15%.
So the thesis in this globe system that you're proposing is really, it's about this top-up tax, is that correct?
Yes. So it's basically how this top-up tax works. And we estimated in work done by the IMF in the Fiscal Monitor, for example, in 2022 and in a policy paper in 2023, that this minimum tax would raise global corporate income tax revenue by about 6%.
Mm-hmm. Wait, in numbers, what does that mean?
Around $150 billion. Of course, it depends on the year, but that's globally. So then what we said is, and we analyzed, is that the real impact will be how companies and countries will react, what we call dynamic response to the agreement. Mm-hmm. So this 6% of global corporate income tax is kind of static impact just because of the global rules application themselves, because simply we raise the rate from 0 to 15 on many activities. But the whole idea is to trigger, hopefully, behavior responses. And mm-hmm. these behavior responses manifest themselves in two ways. One, countries can now take that agreement as an opportunity to implement wider reforms. Say, if you are a country offering a tax holiday, now you can revisit your tax incentives regime, get rid of some tax holidays, and so on. But also companies now, because of the reduced profit shifting, they may restructure, and this reduced profit shifting by itself can have a positive impact on global revenue.
Okay. So, Corey, we did not talk about how many countries signed on to this BEPS system, which is, you don't have globe without BEPS, right? So how many, as far as I can see, there are a lot of countries that have signed on to it, but also countries that remain reluctant to do so. Why are some countries, like the US, for example, hesitating to sign on to this BEPS system?
There's a few reasons, mm-hmm. and so you basically have to characterize countries into what is the obstacle to implementing what's been agreed. In the US case, it requires congressional action, mm-hmm. and it requires one aspect to sign an international treaty, which is difficult for congressional action to achieve. So the US is also in a special case because it had a reform before this new BEPS wave was agreed, and so it already has some minimum taxes in its 2017 reform. So also, before Congress reforms what was put in place in 2017, there's a deal to have them coexist, and let's just see whether they can coexist in some way, shape, or form, rather than achieving full alignment. So in the US is behind the global minimum tax as an idea. Okay. It already has some rules enacted before the technical rules were agreed, and there's a question about whether they align them or not. Some other countries, they just don't understand the rules. And so, you know, lots of the countries that we look after, which are lower capacity countries, really need to work out what they need to do or anything at all. And so I think the starting point is a low tax jurisdiction can do nothing, but the rules have been designed to subject the profits in that low tax jurisdiction to 15%, either because someone else is going to tax it or you tax it yourself. And so countries are now thinking about taxing it themselves, because why wouldn't you rationally? But the rules are designed to not require it. And so at the end of the day, I think the system could coexist even if a low tax jurisdiction does not act. But part of our working paper was encouraging countries, because of the way the system has been designed, to think about strategically about your response and design something that's in your best interests, essentially, both fiscally and as a legal policy matter in terms of how you implement the rules. So that is a unique aspect of the working paper we put out.
So, Shafiq, with this international initiative or push to get a fairer tax system out there, or international tax framework, whatever you might want to call it, how does the IMF, you both work for the IMF, how does the IMF fit into trying to move this forward?
First, we contribute to the global debate through our analytical agenda. Mm-hmm. So we do quantify the available reform options. We do also study and analyze other possible, reform options. And these type of studies and analysis guide and inform, basically, decision-making. That's one. Second, our capacity development work, of course, where we directly advise countries on improving their taxation and tax matters, actually on all fronts, policy, administration, and the underlying legal framework that ultimately translate the policy and administrative objectives.
Now, I got to say, that's very significant, right? There's no other institution that provides the support to these countries that the IMF does.
Exactly, because we have this multidisciplinary, basically, approach. So we have economic analysis, legal analysis, and hand-on administrative advice as well. And we combine all these three work streams in our capacity development work. And moreover, we look at these issues kind of through a wider lens, so to say. So basically, it's not only about implementing a specific package of international reform, but it's about, okay, what are the issues in this country? What are the capacity constraints? And we know, for instance, to achieve the sustainable development goals in many low-income countries, we need multiple points of GDP in revenue. Mm-hmm. And that means no matter how perfect the taxation of multinationals is, and that's, we should inspire and we should aim at improving this, and the revenue from improving, you know, taxation of multinationals is certainly welcome. However, it's not enough. This means we need also to look at other tax areas. And then we need to prioritize and sequence these reforms. So our capacity development, of course, looks at these issues of Globi and the minimum tax, but go beyond a one-to-one implementation of this specific package to put things into wider perspective.
Super interesting. Thanks to you both for joining the podcast today. Corey Hillier is a senior counsel in the legal department, and Shafiq Hibous is a deputy division chief in the fiscal affairs department at the IMF, of course. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Look for Shafiq and Corey's latest research paper on a minimum corporate tax and the global anti-base erosion rules at imf.org. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.